From Public Radio International, this is The World. A co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. It's Thursday, August 4th. I'm Lisa Mullins in Boston. Syria's President Bashar al-Assad authorizes opposition parties. Protesters have demanded an end to one-party rule, but one activist says this offer is too little too late.
It's beyond my imagination to think that any kind of reconciliation could take place with someone who has so brutally massacred his people.
Also, the United Nations says it'll take decades to clean up the oil that's contaminated much of Nigeria.
It has gone much further and much deeper into the land than previously had been supposed.
PRI's The World is brought to you with support from Medtronic, leveraging products, people, and philanthropy to help lessen the global impact of chronic non-communicable diseases such as diabetes and heart disease, and announcing that this September, world leaders will come together at the United Nations to chart a global response to this health issue. Learn more at Medtronic.com. And by IBM, working to help mid-sized businesses become the engines of a smarter planet. Learn more at ibm.com/engines.
I'm Lisa Mullins, and this is The World. The uprising against Syrian President Bashar al-Assad is being met by increasingly brutal force. That's especially true in Hama. The city is enduring great shortages of food and medicine after a five-day siege by government forces. Meanwhile, more than 15,000 refugees have fled Syria for Turkey. Most of them are living in refugee camps right along the border, and most of them are grateful to Turkey for allowing them in. Still, many feel like prisoners. They're not supposed to leave the camps or tell their stories. Matthew Brunwasser begins his report at the Yayladaw tent city.
These Syrian refugees are desperate for their voices to be heard. But Turkey doesn't want you to hear them. This protest after Friday prayers could only be recorded from outside the fence. Journalists are not allowed inside the camp, except during the occasional specially organized media event. The refugees' chants demand the ouster of Syrian President Bashar Assad. The camp perimeter is patrolled by Turkish police, so I'm not able to speak to anyone through the fence. But one refugee snuck out of the camp to tell me his story, at the risk of being sent back to Syria if caught. He doesn't want to use his name. He speaks for an hour about the protests and increasing violence and chaos in his hometown, Jizr al-Shagur. During a protest, he said, unarmed demonstrators were shot and killed by the Shabiha, a militia loyal to Assad. Thousands of demonstrators gathered for the funeral, angry at the deaths of their comrades.
We all went to the graveyard to bury them, and when we were coming back, the Shabiha and military police started shooting at us with automatic rifles. The regular military didn't want to shoot at us, so the soldiers started to fight against the Shabiha and the military police. Many civilians were killed in the battle.
The Syrian government claims that 120 soldiers were killed by armed gangs in what it calls the heinous massacre at Jizr al-Shagur. It's not only journalists being denied access. Refugee and human rights organizations are having an equally hard time. Peter Buchart is with Human Rights Watch.
The restrictions are quite unusually severe. They really are trying to keep whoever they can out of these camps.
Buchart says under international law, which Turkey recognizes, refugees should be allowed to live wherever they want.
In my opinion, the Turkish authorities are afraid that if they allow the Syrian refugees to freely tell their stories, that information about atrocities being committed inside Syria will be generated from Turkish soil and that they will have a problem with their neighbor.
Relations across the 500-mile Syrian-Turkish border are tense already. In the past few weeks, the Turkish Prime Minister, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, has used strong words against the Syrian president. As recently as May, after protests had already started, the Prime Minister referred to Assad as a good friend. Syrian opposition activist Omar al-Mukhtad says Turkey is still trying to decide whether to back the Syrian regime or the Syrian nation.
The Turkish government has a strong relations with the Syrian regime before, and now they are trying to make like a balance between Syrian regime and Syrian nation. So they are trying to stand at the middle of this mess.
At the Turkish Foreign Ministry, spokesman Selçuk Ünal denies that Turkey is playing politics in the refugee camps. Turkey is concerned about the refugees' safety, he says, many of whom don't want to talk to the media because of well-founded fears of reprisals in Syria.
The security and the order of the camps and order of, course, adjacent areas is also an important issue for us.
Ünal says there is no reason to think Turkey wants to silence bad news coming from Syria. And he says the prime minister's strong words against Assad are evidence of that. But despite what Ünal says, at the Reyhan Le camp, it seems residents are eager to talk. I give a small recorder to a refugee to smuggle inside and gather stories. This is Yusuf Ismail from Harbat al-Joz. Ismail says he was just talking with some relatives back home, and they said they found two corpses with their tongues cut out, so badly beaten they couldn't be identified. Reyhan Le recently held elections for camp-wide committees. Mahmoud Musa, an earnest schoolmaster from Jizr al-Shakur, was elected to the media council and finagled special permission to talk to a reporter. While camp personnel treat the Syrians with compassion, he says, it's the Turkish government's policy he finds confusing.
In Syria, you can't come in as a journalist. And also here in Turkey, in the camps, you can't come in. So we asked the Turkish government, why?
Turkey still calls the Syrians in the camps guests and not refugees. And with protests in Syria expected to pick up now during the holy month of Ramadan, the fine line Turkey maintains between the two sides will get more precarious. The crackdown by the Assad government shows no sign of easing. For The World, I'm Matthew Brunwasser, Reyhan Le, Turkey.
You can't go in, but you can see those refugee camps along the Turkish-Syrian border. We've got photographs at theworld.org. As Bashar al-Assad continues his crackdown, he's also acknowledging the need for reform. Today, the Syrian leader issued a decree to allow a multi-party political system. President Assad's ruling Ba'ath Party has enjoyed a monopoly on power since 1963. Syrian protesters have demanded an end to the one-party rule. Still, Assad's decree does not impress New York-based Arab activist Mona Al-Tahawi.
At this stage in the Syrian revolution, I don't take seriously anything that Bashar al-Assad says. If he had made this offer months ago, when the uprising first started, I might have thought, you know, perhaps he really means it, perhaps he's serious. But I think after the tremendous amount of bloodshed that has resulted from his vicious onslaught against anyone rising up against him, I cannot imagine anybody in Syria right now actually seeing a future for Bashar al-Assad. It's beyond my imagination to think that any kind of reconciliation could take place with someone who has so brutally massacred his people.
What kind of future could you imagine, though, especially with the amount of firepower that he's using on civilians now?
A lot of people, first of all, never imagined that Syria would join the countries in the region, in the Middle East and North Africa, that would see an uprising. But not only have we seen Syria join, but every week we see more and more people join. We see more and more towns that had been quiet join the revolution. So what I see is basically Bashar al-Assad desperately trying to squash this revolution and failing to do so. The Syrians themselves will have to decide what kind of future government they want. The Syrians themselves will have to decide the future of Bashar al-Assad, because it really all does depend on how long they can maintain their revolution. But as far as, you know, looking back to March when they started it to today, it's even bigger than anyone could have ever imagined.
I think it's pretty safe to assume that there are leaders like Bashar al-Assad who are watching what's happening right now with the trial of your former president, Hosni Mubarak, in Egypt. And I wonder to what extent, since you were just in Egypt yourself, people there are paying attention to what's happening in places like Syria.
Oh, people are very much paying attention to what's happening in Syria. I know the Syrians are worried that we in Egypt are distracted by the Mubarak trial. But believe me, everybody in the region is watching everybody else, because it's this great communal sense of we're all in it together against these tyrants who've ruined our lives for so long. You know, in the 60s, we would hear a lot about Arab nationalism, thanks to Gamal Abdel Nasser and his pan-Arab vision. And back then, you know, there really was a sense that the Arab world could be one. And that sense has deteriorated over the past few years because of a number of things. But recently, we've seen this sense that the region is one, that the people, much more importantly, that the people of the region are one. And they watch and pay very close attention, because remember, it was Tunisia that sparked our imagination in the region. Tunisia got rid of Ben Ali and kicked down this iron door that had locked our imaginations in. And Tunisia allowed us to imagine a future beyond our dictators. And everybody was watching Tunisia. And then everybody started watching Egypt. And then Bahrain and Yemen and Libya and Syria. So everybody is paying attention. And I think if there's one message that's been coming out of Egypt, especially since we saw Mubarak in that cage as a defendant, finally, it's that you can do this. You, the people of Syria, you, the people of Yemen or Libya or any other country, you too can hold your tyrant accountable.
Mona El-Tahawi, Egyptian activist who's just back from Egypt. Thank you.
Thank you.
As Mona El-Tahawi mentioned, Tunisians sparked the Arab Spring when they got rid of President Zine Abidine Ben Ali. He fled to Saudi Arabia after his fall from power. Ben Ali has since been tried in absentia in Tunisia and found guilty. Pretty safe to say that many Tunisians are watching the Mubarak trial in Egypt with some degree of envy. But Tunis-based journalist Mourad Tayeb says putting former dictators behind bars is not the main goal of most Tunisians.
They know Mubarak, as well as Ben Ali and other Arab dictators, have to be tried, and they think what they will gain from this trial is not the sentencing of Mubarak or Ben Ali, but rather to restore justice.
Do Tunisians believe that they will ever see the day when their former president Ben Ali will return to Tunisia? Because he's in Saudi Arabia right now. He's been tried in absentia
nobody
twice.
Nobody believes in that. Nobody expects him to be judged in Tunisia. They know bringing Ben Ali back to Tunisia is a high political issue that nobody can decide but Saudi Arabia. So they don't believe in him coming back to Tunisia to be judged. Tunisians rather aspire to see Ben Ali's clan, rather than himself, be tried and justice restored.
Well, you're talking about the case of 23 relatives and allies of Ben Ali, the former president, who are facing charges now, including illegal possession of foreign currency, trafficking in jewelry, and attempted flight from the country. What is the latest on that trial?
The trial of the 23 people from the Ben Ali clan has been more fascinating, more interesting to Tunisians than the Ben Ali trial a week ago. People tend to forget about Ben Ali as a person and concentrate on his clan, on his family, and people really hate these people and want them to be sentenced or jailed.
Is it that they have actual people to put on trial, and that's why this matters more than trying the former president in absentia?
Yeah. Tunisians will never forgive these people from the Ben Ali clan. There are already bad news. Yesterday and today, two former ministers of the Ben Ali government have been released, and people are very angry towards that.
Mourad, just one more question. Does it seem as if the people of Tunisia will not be able to move forward until these trials are behind them?
I don't think the coming elections in October or any other decision will convince Tunisians. Only fair trials and courageous decisions towards the Ben Ali clan will satisfy Tunisians.
Thank you for talking with us, Tunisian journalist Mourad Tayeb in the capital, Tunis. Thanks very much, Mourad.
Thank you very much.
Coming up later, augmented reality along the border between the Koreas on PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Medtronic, leveraging products, people, and philanthropy to help lessen the global impact of chronic non-communicable diseases such as diabetes and heart disease, and announcing that this September, world leaders will come together at the United Nations to chart a global response to this health issue. Learn more at Medtronic.com. And by IBM, working to help mid-sized businesses become the engines of a smarter planet. Learn more at ibm.com/engines.
I'm Lisa Mullins, and this is The World. That's the fast-flowing sound of Tamil, one of 22 official languages of India. Now, Tamil isn't as well-known as some of India's other languages, such as Hindi or Bengali, but more than 60 million Indians speak it, and another 10 million in Sri Lanka. That makes Tamil more widely spoken today than, say, Italian or Turkish. But the language is at a crossroads. From the Indian city of Chennai, The World's Alex Galifant reports.
Tamil is in crisis. It has so many problems.
Problems in terms of meaning, problems in terms of form of a word, problems in terms of syntax.
So says Ramakrishnan, a man on a mission to standardize modern Tamil. Sounds like it does need an update.
We don't have a comprehensive grammar of modern Tamil. The last grammar was written in the 12th century.
That's not to say Tamil is an endangered language. It isn't. All those millions of people aren't going to suddenly stop speaking Tamil anytime soon. Still, it is struggling. Ramakrishnan runs a small Tamil language publishing house. This is a portion from a recent book of short stories. The written Tamil he's reading aloud is different to the spoken Tamil people use every day. Tamil shares that feature with several other languages, notably Arabic. For many, writing in Tamil can be off-putting. Ask someone to try, says Ramakrishnan, and you'll get this.
Oh no, I can't write Tamil. The reason he says is subconsciously he thinks if he writes, it should conform to the classical standards.
Tamil language has got lost in the sense of nostalgia, which does not enable it to be a modern language.
Sadanand Menon is a well-known writer in Chennai. He says that after the British left India, local politicians used the centuries-old classical Tamil of epics and royalty to define a proud regional identity. Since then, politics has moved on, but day-to-day Tamil hasn't really.
So, like if we were discussing this instrument that you're holding in Tamil, just about everything that is part of your recorder, your microphone, your earphone, everything, I'll have to use English words. Tamil has got locked in the past and hasn't found a device to describe what is happening around them at the moment.
That's reminiscent of the challenge Hebrew faced at the turn of the 20th century. It couldn't describe the modern world either. Now it's a fully functioning modern language, and classical Hebrew is a different animal altogether. Arguably, it took the building of a nation to produce such a radical shift. But there's no such impulse for Indian Tamils, who got their own state within India in 1969, Tamil Nadu. Besides, now they're hungry for something else, English.
Friendship, love.
English words are scattered across Tamil movies and songs. Sadanand Menon rolls his eyes at choruses like this.
Shakalaka baby, will you fall in love with me?
But it's not just pop culture. English is infiltrating everyday life too. Ramakrishnan worries that people in Tamil Nadu, especially the poorly educated, know neither English nor Tamil very well, and get by only with a limited mashup of the two. He says you can't even give directions to a local cab driver without using English.
So today, if I tell my driver, Valadupakkam thirumbu, that is turn right, he will not understand. I must tell him, right lapo, left lapo, straight upo.
The local government has been trying to improve Tamil's status. A new law requires business signs to be written in Tamil as well as English. The same kind of thing happened years ago in French-speaking Quebec. And official committees have invented thousands of new words, although it's not clear they're being used. Then again, between Tamil and English, people are getting on okay. English words often gain new meanings in Tamil. Assault, for example, has come to mean casual. And in the last couple of decades, there has been an explosion of contemporary Tamil fiction. Those books are written in an updated form of the language. But that kind of writing is the exception. The general standard of written Tamil isn't very high. And so, in purely economic terms, its value is limited. The language can't take your business around the world, like English, or even across India, like Hindi. To do that, says Ramakrishnan, Tamil needs clarity and consistency.
We don't have a grammar, we don't have a thesaurus, we don't have a good English-Tamil dictionary. We need so many things.
For years now, he's been building his own Tamil dictionary, painstakingly charting the modern use of the language. Take the Tamil word for put.
See this? 54 senses.
That one word and its 54 shades of meaning took him weeks.
If you have to spend nearly 1 month on one word, what do you call it? Except madness.
Maybe, maybe not. No language can be modernized in isolation. Along with the challenge of English, the Tamil spoken in India has to contend with, say, how the language is used in Sri Lanka and how it's morphing online. So a few rules along the way can help.
Indicative, negative, imperative, optative, infinitive.
For the world, I'm Alex Galifant, Chennai, India.
Conditional, causal, temporal, mood.
For more of our reporting on languages, check out our weekly podcast called The World in Words. Just head to theworld.org/language. You can listen there or subscribe through iTunes and follow our language feed on Twitter. Again, it's all at theworld.org/language. Also today, the United Nations is calling for the largest and perhaps the most expensive oil spill cleanup ever in the Ogoniland region of Nigeria. A new report from the agency's environment program says oil spills there have contaminated land, water and air, and threatened public health for a half century. The report described oil slicks 3 inches thick floating on water used for drinking. It's also found levels of the carcinogen benzene in one community at 900 times global health standards. The UN blames the swath of contamination partly on vandalism of oil pipelines, but it also holds the oil company Shell accountable for not following its own environmental guidelines. The UN's Environment Program spokesman Nick Nuttall says that the report highlights the massive scale of oil-related pollution in the region.
The United Nations Environment Program over 14 months has toured the length and breadth of Ogoniland to assess the oil pollution. It is serious. It has gone much further and much deeper into the land than previously had been supposed. And there is an urgent need now to catalyze a major cleanup of this region. It's going to take at least 25 years to restore the health of Ogoniland back to pre-oil days, but a lot can be achieved within 5 years in terms of cleaning up the drinking water.
Some environmentalists say oil is poured into the Niger River over the past 50 years at a rate of roughly one Exxon Valdez disaster per year. Shell, this week, accepted responsibility for 2 oil spills in the region, but Nick Nuttall says it's now up to the Nigerian government to act on the report.
Probably quite clear that the oil industry will have to shoulder a significant part of this cost. But that's not for us to decide. That's something for the president to decide and for his presidential implementation committee.
The UN report suggests the Nigerian government and the oil industry set up an initial $1 billion fund for the cleanup. We'll be right back. More news and music and our GeoQuiz coming up on PRI. I'm Lisa Mullins. People in North Korea are going hungry again. The U.S. is not sending aid, but the two countries are starting to talk. Also ahead, we look for a missing work of art.
It's got a tree and a couple of bushes, and it's a kind of tapered base with soil and roots and stuff. And it's about 7 meters wide and about 6 meters high, so it's pretty sizable.
PRI's The World is brought to you with support from Medtronic, leveraging products, people, and philanthropy to help lessen the global impact of chronic non-communicable diseases such as diabetes and heart disease, and announcing that this September, world leaders will come together at the United Nations to chart a global response to this health issue. Learn more at Medtronic.com and by IBM, working to help mid-sized businesses become the engines of a smarter planet. Learn more at IBM.com/engines.
I'm Lisa Mullins, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. North Koreans are once again going hungry. The United Nations World Food Program says about a quarter of the population is in need of food this year. But so far, the United States isn't giving aid. It doesn't want to reward Pyongyang's bad behavior. That behavior includes walking away from a nuclear agreement and staging two attacks in South Korea last year. But as the world's Mary Kay Magstead reports, the U.S. and North Korea are starting to talk.
North Korea cannot feed itself, and it's gotten little food aid over the past couple of years, except from China, due to its own belligerent actions. The World Food Program's Asia spokesman, Marcus Pryor, says North Korea is now in crisis.
And our staff now, as the lean season, as it's known, gets deeper, are seeing more and more children admitted to hospitals suffering from acute malnutrition. So we are very concerned, and we continue to urge the international community to support our operation.
The World Food Program's assessment early this year found about 6 million people were either already malnourished or at risk. The WFP is now feeding 3.5 million of them, with other aid agencies helping the rest. So far, the United States has stayed on the sidelines. Washington notes that North Korea says it doesn't have enough money to buy food on the international market, but does have enough money for its nuclear program, its million-man military, and this. Its annual mass games extravaganza, with a cast of 100,000 and a cost of many millions of dollars. This year's mass games just started. Daniel Pinkston, the International Crisis Group's Korea specialist, says while he believes the WFP's assessment, he's a little skeptical of Pyongyang's motives.
I certainly think the North Korean authorities are exaggerating the problem slightly as part of an effort to acquire international aid. Next year is an important year politically for North Korea, and in the context of the transition to the next generation of leadership, the state wants to provide consumer goods to the population to demonstrate that the state is performing well and providing prosperity to its citizens.
Whatever its internal imperatives, the North Korean government is suddenly playing a new game. Last week, North Korea envoy Kim Gae-gwan met for 2 days in New York with U.S. negotiator Stephen Bosworth. Jonathan Pollock of the Brookings Institution just wrote a book on North Korea's nuclear program called No Exit. Pollock says the Obama administration may have decided to re-engage with North Korea for one of the same reasons China stays engaged.
The real Chinese fear, I believe, is if North Korea is truly cornered, they will do something very dangerous that would then quite possibly elicit a retaliation from South Korea and then envelop Northeast Asia in a crisis yet again that China could not get away from, and the United States would, of course, be directly involved.
The talks last week seemed to bear at least the seeds of future progress. North Korea announced it's willing to go back to the negotiating table without preconditions. It walked away 2.5 years ago. Kim Gae-gwan said as a first step, North Korea would like a peace treaty to end the Korean War. There was only a ceasefire in 1953. Again, Daniel Pinkston.
A peace treaty to end the Korean War, from the North Korean perspective, would trigger other outcomes, including the withdrawal of U.S. forces from South Korea, from Northeast Asia.
Pinkston says that's a non-starter from the U.S. perspective. But even with a food shortage, North Korea is nothing if not ambitious at the negotiating table. It could point to how it's in a position of strength, with a nuclear weapons program, a long-range missile that might be able to hit the U.S. territory of Guam, and a new space station from which they might test it. Still, Pinkston says, talks may yet be able to curb North Korea's nuclear ambitions.
However imperfect it might be, imposing or implementing some types of agreements that slow down the program, that's better than nothing at all. And if there are no constraints and they continue to develop their nuclear weapons, then we could be less secure.
For each side, this may be a time of choosing the least bad option. For the United States, of preventing even worse instability on the Korean Peninsula. For North Korea, coming to the table, at least in part, so more North Koreans have food on the table. For the world, I'm Mary Kay Magstad in Beijing.
Many Koreans dream of seeing the border between North and South free of weapons and checkpoints and walls and barriers. Well, soon they may be able to, at least virtually. The Augmented Reality Korean Unification Project is being launched this month. The idea is to allow people to see an alternate reality when they look at the demilitarized zone that separates the Koreas. Michael Skwarek is developing the project. The New York-based artist has a goal.
To allow the general public, the Korean people, to view this location and show them what it could look like or would look like if the conflict was no longer taking place. I think of possibly older people who may never see a united Korea, which is probably a very likely thing, and they would sort of give them one last sort of look or something like that. And it is what it is. We're not actually healing the border, so I'm not making any kind of broad claims, but I think what it would do is it's sort of the idea. We're trying to go back to the idea of the unified Korea, and maybe if it's sort of keeping that fire alive, keeping the hope alive that something like this can come to pass soon.
So what would I, if I were standing at the border, what would we need to be looking at? I mean, what would we have in our hands?
You would have a smartphone or a mobile device. So this could be Android or iPhone. It would have to be a 3GS iPhone or newer. And you could stand there with this phone, you would load up the app, and then what would happen is you would hold it out in front of yourself, and then you would see the model appear in front of you, and it would sort of cover over the fortifications, the obstructions in that space.
So what's there instead?
Nature, essentially. So you wouldn't, it would be a continuous valley instead of the obstacles which are dividing both North and South Korea. So it's an additive process as well.
But what are you adding?
Sometimes you'd be adding trees, you would be adding maybe rice paddies, you could add just the natural topography.
Can you pan with this?
Yes, you can. You would be able to stand in place and you could sort of pivot for the best results. You'd be standing in place, holding the device in front of you like a looking glass. Think if you were looking through like a magnifying glass or a looking glass. You're using that tablet or that smartphone as a looking glass, and you can kind of pan back and forth and you can see the space. And what you would see is bits of the physical reality, and then it would be mixed with these 3D objects. So it's kind of a collage, a 3D collage of virtual 3D computer-generated objects in the physical world.
Really briefly, tell us about the part of this that's augmented reality.
What's happening is, think of it, the way we create our art is we take these 3D models and put them into physical space. So it's sort of like using your computer, but it's all around you all the time. And it's spatialized, so I can kind of walk around it and it can move with me. The way that we work mainly would be very similar to using a Google map. If people were to use a pen, you create a pen and a marker and place it on that map and say, I put a pen at my house. What we're doing, or I'm doing, is actually putting a model there. Instead of showing where my house is, I'm putting a model at a specific point in space. And this software that we're using will calculate the GPS, where that model is supposed to be located, and you can actually go to that place, turn your phone on, and then see the model, walk around it, and view the art. What this basically allows us to do is, or allows me to do, would be to put art in places that would be very difficult to do it using any other medium.
It's a fascinating project. We wish you the best on it. New media artist Mark Skorek, who has developed the augmented reality Korean unification project that unites South and North Korea, at least with the use of a smartphone. Mark, thank you.
Thanks a lot.
You can have a peek at the augmented reality of the Korean DMZ through our website, theworld.org. About an hour's ride north of the DMZ, there's a North Korean vacation resort that greets visitors with this music. It's a hearty welcome to a grand experiment between the North and South. That experiment is the Mount Kumgong Special Tourism Zone. It's a complex of hotels, restaurants, paths, and trails around Mount Kumgong. The resort was developed in the 1990s by the South's Hyundai Asan Company as a way to create economic ties. It's attracted thousands of tourists from South Korea and brought millions of dollars into the North. But 3 years ago, one of the many North Korean soldiers posted at the resort shot and killed a South Korean woman who strayed from the mountain path. South Korea retaliated by stopping all tours. The North then seized control of the resort from Hyundai and threatened to sell South Korea's assets. Now there's a new development. Just yesterday came news that a New York-based company has signed a deal to operate tours to Mount Kumgong in North Korea. By the way, a couple of years ago, I got to spend the night at the Mount Kumgong Resort in North Korea. You can check out my story at theworld.org. Now, on to Tokyo, where it's a pretty hot summer. Actually, temperatures have been normal, but there's not a lot of chance to escape the heat. You see, Japan's had a shortage of electricity since an earthquake and tsunami destroyed the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant on March 11th. The prime minister says Japan should rely less on nuclear power and more on renewable energy sources. That's all well and good. But for now, electricity and air conditioning are at a premium. And Liz Ruskin reports that the Japanese are conserving energy any way they can.
Lobbies of public buildings these days are dark and stuffy. City streets aren't so bright at night. And the air conditioning is off in Tokyo subway stations for 3 hot hours each afternoon. On this sweltering train platform, the escalators aren't budging. Commuters brandish hand fans and blot their faces with towels. Japan is making do with significantly less electricity than it had last year. The government has ordered commercial users in Tokyo and eastern Japan to cut their peak use by 15%. Worse than the potential fine, companies fear being viewed as wasteful or putting the whole region in danger of blackout. So Japan is sacrificing some comforts this summer and sweating it out. It comes naturally, says this engineer, Shintaro Yazuka.
I think that is a kind of Japanese national character. Japanese can do it.
Some companies are greening up to meet the power shortage, and that is no metaphor. Hitachi, for example, has distributed seeds of the Goya plant, a fast-growing vine, to its 200 work sites around Japan. They've got instructions on how to grow a green curtain, a leafy barrier to insulate buildings from the heat. Kyocera, an electronics component maker, claims the vines on its buildings reduce outside wall temperatures by as much as 27 degrees Fahrenheit. But few Tokyo office towers are suited for thick foliage. To keep the populace from passing out for lack of air conditioning, the government is urging Japan's legions of salarymen to lose the dark suit and come to work in short sleeves. Actually, the government does something like this every summer to reduce air conditioning use. It's a campaign called Cool Biz. Think Casual Friday every day. This year, the Environment Ministry has deployed Super Cool Biz, encouraging polo shirts, Hawaiian shirts, even sandals as appropriate office wear for men. Here's a trick many companies are using to shift their energy use to off-peak hours. Redefine the term weekend. Toyota's weekend is now Thursday and Friday. At Casio, it's Wednesday and Sunday. Managers at Geol, a company that makes electron microscopes west of Tokyo, have so far been able to meet their target by just seriously clamping down. This was already a no-frills kind of workplace with cavernous rooms that appear to be unchanged since the company started production in the 1950s. Now, they've set thermostats at 82. They've disabled half of all light fixtures. Adding to the gloom, they've blanketed their buildings with black agricultural shade cloth to keep the sun off the windows. Employees have even had to forfeit their electric tea kettles. As the last line of defense, they've hung what looks like a taxi meter on the wall in one of their work areas. It's connected, says facilities manager Katsuji Ienaga, to something like a doorbell.
This is a meter we call demand meter, showing the power use. And when this number reaches 5,200 or 300, this chime rings and people around here come and check it and then go to the announce room.
Once they sound the alarm across the company, employees will run around unplugging fans and computers, bringing their power use down within minutes. They've run drills. Despite the disruption and discomfort, Ienaga says his employees aren't complaining.
Well, they understand the situation of Japan since 11th of March.
No one is to blame for the power shortage, as he sees it. It was the fault of the tsunami, and it's hard to complain about the inconvenience that's causing in Tokyo when the loss was so great up north. For The World, this is Liz Ruskin in Tokyo.
This is BRI, Public Radio International. I'm Lisa Mullins, and this is The World. Today's GeoQuiz is floating on by. Now, this is not your usual quiz. We're not asking you to name a country or a region or city or river. Rather, we're looking for a piece of art. It counts as a GeoQuiz, though, in our book, because it's an artwork of an island.
So it's a big helium-filled structure.
British artist Sarah Cockings co-created the artwork.
It's kind of reminiscent of almost a less cartoonesque version of Never Never Land or the islands in Avatar. And it's covered, it's got a tree and a couple of bushes, and it's a kind of tapered base with soil and roots and stuff. And it's about 7 meters wide and about 6 meters high, so it's pretty sizable.
And its name, we're going to tell you right now. The answer to the GeoQuiz today is Island, I-S-L-A-N-D. When we said we're looking for it, we really meant it. You see, Ms. Cockings was going to take her Island to the Nevada desert for the Burning Man Festival, the big one happening later this month. But first she took Island to the Secret Garden Festival in England. and that's where some pranksters cut the rope that was holding it down.
So, yeah, it was tethered over a lake, and it was rebarred into the ground. We used a kind of nylon rope.
And do you know exactly what they did? I mean, did anybody see them cutting the nylon rope?
It's all a bit vague, to be honest. All I have in terms of a kind of witness account is a handful of young guys down by the river, cutting the ropes, the balloon's gone, and then just kind of disappeared into the atmosphere.
Were you thinking at the time, you know, about this island, as you call it, safety and whether it would last, or were you thinking about all the time you put into making it?
To be perfectly honest, all the time I put into making it, I mean, we called the local aviation authorities and local airports and anyone that kind of was in control of general chartered airspace, because obviously, you know, it could have gone up and intercepted a Ryanair flight or something. So we were a little bit concerned, but, you know, there were no sightings of it from air traffic control or anywhere like that. We had a few sightings on the morning it went missing, but they've only started to come in now because obviously people didn't know who to contact or whether they were hallucinating. So yeah, we've got a few sightings. Some of them are hilarious. A woman in Swanage thinks she saw it in the sea and thought it might be the Loch Ness Monster on sabbatical.
So this is made of durable polyethylene. It's helium filled. How long do you think it can stay afloat?
It's quite hard to say. It's got kind of 50 cubic meters of helium in, which is a fair bit of helium. And with a normal helium balloon, it would kind of go up, pop, and kind of come back to Earth. But this has got inbuilt valves. When it gets very hot and helium expands, it can kind of be let out, and then I can reinflate it so it never bursts. So this kind of means that it could have gone very, very high. And the thought of it up there, kind of in the cold hemisphere, it almost sends shivers down my spine. It's strange. Or floating in the sea, that's the other thing I kind of envisioned. It would still kind of bob on the surface.
Do you hear like a Robinson Crusoe story here in the making?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, that's the dream. I would love it if initially I was hoping somebody on a, you know, on a Virgin Atlantic flight to the Czech Republic would film on their phone, and you know, that would just be incredible. Or if it landed in the Nevada desert, that would be good too.
It would already be where you wanted it to end up in the first place.
Yeah, absolutely. The really good news is that Secret Garden, who've been so supportive through all of this, and I just want to kind of sing their praises because they are offering to fund a new one, get a new balloon to be made.
Sarah Cockings, thank you, and we hope for the best. At least we hope that you and maybe the successor balloon makes it to Nevada.
Yeah, we're on our way, so it's all good. Cheers. Bye-bye.
Finally today, rock groups in Kosovo don't often make much of a splash beyond the Balkans. Take the band Gillespie. They have a big fan base at home, but they dream of getting out and about in the world. Nate Tabak reports from Pristina.
As guitarist Gurish Godra tells it, his band Gillespie didn't set out to shake up Pristina's underground rock world. It just sort of happened.
We closed ourselves in a basement for a year. We did some material and stuff, and then accidentally we got into a scene because a lot of our friends were curious to know what was going on in a basement, so they just came there.
And what they found was something people hadn't heard in Kosovo's capital. Gillespie's wistful melodies, commanding bass lines, and lyrics about simple, beautiful things stood in contrast to the political turmoil and social problems that dominate life in post-war Kosovo. That's Lule Djeli, which is Albanian for sunflower. It's off Gillespie's 2006 debut album, An Ordinary Day. The love song topped regional charts, and it caught the attention of MTV producers. They invited the band to open for the Red Hot Chili Peppers in Serbia. It should have been Gillespie's big break, but it fell through. Their security couldn't be guaranteed, and Serbia also wouldn't honor their travel documents. The quartet's frustrations just grew after that. Gillespie went on a 2-year hiatus. The band reformed last fall, but then their lead singer soon quit, only 2 days before a gig in Skopje, Macedonia. With their revival in peril, Gillespie quickly found a replacement, and the problem was solved.
Except that I didn't know the lyrics to the songs.
That's the replacement, Hanna Zecha.
And we got to practice only one day, not day and a half even. Yeah, just 2 hours. We went through all the songs, and we went to Skopje. We played together. I had fun. I didn't know the lyrics. It was fine. Everything was fine. And after that, yeah, that's rock and roll.
Now, more than 6 months later, Zecha is firmly on board, and Gillespie just released their sophomore LP. It's called I Count on an Abacus. Bring on the This track, Anissa, is about a young girl who learns to fly. It channels the innocence and blissful naivete of a nursery rhyme with a slicker, more mature sound than Gillespie's earlier work. The playful lyrics seem to speak to the unrequited desire of Kosovo's young population to see and experience the world. Kosovars need visas to go almost anywhere, including the European Union. That's why Gillespie recently spurned several invitations to play in Western Europe.
We couldn't travel because we needed all the visas in the world and everything. So it's definitely not good to be, first of all, a youngster from Kosovo, and secondly, it's not good to be a band from Kosovo because, you know, you don't really concentrate only on the music part.
Gillespie is taking these frustrations in stride, though, and sticking to a fundamentally positive message in their music. And Škodra is holding on to hope that the band will get that opportunity to speak to a wider audience.
Just give people a chance to show themselves, and then you maybe like it, you know. Who knows? You maybe like it, and then you end up making the life of someone in, I don't know, Brazil happier, you know, or, you know, more cheerful because he likes the music and he smiles every time he listens to it in the morning.
For The World, I'm Nate Tabak, Pristina.
That's all for us today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Lisa Mullins. We're back tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston, supported in part by the Plowshares Fund, investing in peace and security worldwide, plowshares.org. The National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. And by the WGBH Fund for Environmental Reporting, whose donors include the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting a cooperative approach to solving our critical environmental problems while we still can. And NASA, leading research on the Earth and its climate from the vantage point of space.
PRI, Public Radio International.